From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As the FBI requests sweeping new power to monitor tens of thousands of conversations and data transmissions simultaneously in a metropolitan area, we'll take a look at the global intelligence system that allows spy agencies to monitor most of the world's telephone, email, and telex communications. Also, as the press focuses on the failed war on drugs in Colombia, we'll take a look at the U.S.-Colombian war on human rights.
The army battalions which are carrying out the worst human rights abuses are the army battalions which are receiving the most U.S. aid. An estimated 10 or 11 people die every day because of political reasons in the country, and that has nothing to do with the drug cartels. It has to do with people who are branded as being subversives, union leaders in many cases, human rights workers in an endless number of cases, community leaders, teachers, peasant leaders, people like that.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton attended a fundraiser in New York City last night that raised $1 million. According to the New York Post, the Upper East Side fundraiser would be banned by the campaign finance reform he says he backs. The Post says a third of the money raised at the $10,000 a head event at communications investor Shelby Bryan's home was largely unregulated soft money that the president wants regulated. Clinton has come under attack for questionable fundraising practices. Last week, the Washington Post ran a story that suggested the Chinese government funneled money to Clinton's campaign for re-election. Meanwhile, when he was in New York yesterday, he held a panel at Riverside Church on the edge of Harlem. And since President Clinton asked, I'm reading from a piece in the Washington Post today, the speakers delivered. They gave Clinton their thoughts in sharp words on welfare that at one point caused the president to clench his jaw in apparent irritation before launching into a bristling rebuttal in which he defended himself against the accusation that his policies were callous to the poor. The sharpest exchange came between the president and businessman Earl Graves during a discussion on the issue of finding jobs for the needy. Graves, a publisher of Black Enterprise magazine and one of the nation's wealthiest African Americans, declared as he sat on a panel with the president that the Republican-drafted overhaul of welfare Clinton signed last August was aimed at destroying the safety net. And while Clinton is to be commended, he said, for urging businesses to hire people who could be thrown off relief under the new law, Graves said he said many Black churches and businesses are already bearing their fair share of the burden. President Clinton, this news also, this from the Wall Street Journal, the Whitewater prosecutor said the inquiry is going to go on for some time despite his decision to take another job, and that he expects a new independent counsel to be named. Separately, the Justice Department has declined to discipline Starr for alleged conflicts involving his partisan affiliations with an RTC suit against his firm. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
This is Dr. Joycelyn Elders, Mumia Abdul-Jamal, a husband, father, grandfather, an African-American, lives in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America. For over 15 years, he's been a resident of Pennsylvania's Death Row. Tune in to hear this rare and courageous voice speaking from a place we all fear to know. Mumia Abdul-Jamal's rare and impassioned commentaries are certain to fuel the controversy surrounding the death penalty and freedom of speech. Listen to an incisive critic of our criminal justice system speaking from the depths of prison.
That's what capital punishment really means. Those that ain't got the capital gets the punishment, is the old saying. Once again, we see the inherent truths that lie in the Proverbs of the Poor. That old saying echoed when it was announced that the District Attorney of Delaware County, Patrick Meehan, would not seek the death penalty in the case of John E. DuPont. the wealthy corporate heir charged with the shooting death of Olympic champion David Schultz. In one fell swoop, the state ensured that while millionaires may be murderers, they are not eligible for the Preserve of the Poor, America's Death Row.
Hear the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal, censored by NPR, silenced by prison officials, broadcast only by Pacifica, the last week in February on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. That's right, and we will begin airing Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries next Monday. The cellular telephone industry is now claiming that the FBI is demanding sweeping new power to monitor more than 100,000 telephone calls simultaneously. The latest criticism of the FBI's intention stems from the 1994 Digital Telephony Bill that requires telephone companies to make it easy for intelligence and security agencies to electronically monitor voice and data transmissions. In return, the telephone industry gets $500 million. But telephone companies are now saying that the FBI wants much more power at a much higher cost than originally planned. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to take a look at the whole issue of electronic surveillance, both here in the United States and abroad. Joining us to discuss the issues are David Sobel, the legal counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center, known as EPIC, here in Washington, D.C., and Nikki Hager, a researcher and writer from Wellington, New Zealand, and author of Secret Power, New Zealand's Role in the International Spy Network. He wrote the cover story in the latest edition of Covert Action Quarterly called Exposing the Global Surveillance System, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, let's begin with David Sobel, who is the legal counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. David, what about this latest information? I saw it on the Saturday edition of the New York Times in the business section, where telephone companies and industry associations are arguing that this new system that the FBI is calling for will be far more intrusive and expensive than the industry had first thought. What is the FBI requesting?
Okay, this is the latest in a saga that goes back to the early 90s when the FBI first started lobbying for the legislation that you mentioned, a statute that's known as the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. And back in the early 90s, the FBI started arguing that new digital telephone technology was basically outpacing their ability to conduct electronic surveillance. That, in other words, this new telephone technology that was coming online was interfering with their ability to tap telephones. It was a very controversial proposal and really didn't go anywhere for the first couple of years until a deal was struck in 1994 whereby the telephone industry, as you mentioned, would be reimbursed $500 million for basically retrofitting the telephone system to the FBI's specifications. Now, the legislation left open the question as to what those specifications would be. It basically called for the FBI to come up with capacity requirements that would be established and that would be the standard that the industry would have to meet. And what we've now been seeing for the last couple of years has been a lot of controversy surrounding the specifics of those requirements. The Bureau first came out with its capacity requirement notice last year. That proposal was surrounded by a lot of controversy because it was subject to varying interpretations. Some of which, including those that my organization came up with, indicated that the FBI was really asking for a massive expansion in its ability to conduct surveillance. The FBI basically went back to the drawing board, came up with a new proposal that surfaced last month, and that is now the subject of the latest round of controversy, which was reported in the New York Times over the weekend.
I think it's interesting that the FBI hasn't actually put down on paper what it is that they're requesting, so that when the phone companies come out and say they're asking for these massive new sweeping powers, the FBI can say, no, you're misinterpreting. I mean, later in the piece in the New York Times, it says that the Cellular Telephone Industry Association calculated that the Bureau's historical data had shown that the highest number of simultaneous cellular phone taps ever conducted in the nation by local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies was 6,070. This is at once taps of cellular phones. But the Times goes on to say the FBI is now proposing that the cellular industry give law enforcement agencies the ability to monitor 103,190 calls simultaneously. 103,000 calls simultaneously.
Well, and as I say, the FBI disputes those figures, and you know, as you point out, the problem really stems from the fact that the Bureau itself has been unwilling to come forward with firm numbers of what the actual capability is that it wants. They have provided a very confusing
set of what they refer to as baseline figures showing historical wiretapping activity, and they talk about percentage increases from that number over time. And this is broken down on a county by county basis around the country. So it's very difficult to come up with firm figures. I mean, the one thing that we do know is that on a percentage basis, they are talking about a very substantial increase. We interpret their numbers to be saying that by the year 2004, which isn't that far off in the future, the FBI is estimating a total increase of 74% in increases of landline telephones.
You mean analog telephones?
Well, no, wire-based telephones. And 277% in wireless telephone communications.
Who are they tapping? Who do they want to tap?
Well, I mean, this is also a subject of some dispute. The FBI, in support of
this proposal and in support of the legislation 2 years ago, has always argued that they need this capability to get at terrorists and kidnappers and violent criminals. And in fact, when you look at the statistics over the last 20 years, the reality is that wiretapping is predominantly, almost exclusively, used in investigations of narcotics and gambling. So that's really what we're talking about. But of course, they like to raise the specter of terrorism in support of this proposal. The figures just don't bear out that's what this technique is used to investigate.
So right now, when the FBI goes to the telephone companies and the industry associations to ask that they retrofit all their technology to allow these tens of thousands of conversations to be tapped, the legislation is already there. They don't have to go back to Congress right now. They just have to get the cooperation of corporations.
That's right. Once the standards are established, that will be the level of capacity that the telephone industry will be required to provide under penalty of criminal sanctions. And at that point, they will also be entitled to request reimbursement from the government, as we mentioned, up to $500 million.
Is EPIC, your organization, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, involved with any organizing around this right now?
We have been very active on the surveillance issue going back to the early 90s when the proposals first surfaced. We are, for the most part, an internet-based and oriented organization, and have done a lot of work online
educating people about this issue, and this proposal has always been very unpopular within the internet community, because people recognize that when you talk about electronic surveillance and redesigning the communication system, that a major target of all of this ultimately is the internet.
In fact, is there right now requests by the FBI to internet providers, of service providers, access providers, to do the same thing for the internet?
Well, we haven't gotten to that point yet, but I mean, clearly, when you're talking about the ability to tap into the digital telephone system, in effect, you are talking about data communications. So it's not clear that it's even necessary to get at this from the ISP level. Once the FBI has the access that they want to digital telephone switches, that brings them a long way towards doing internet tapping.
I want to bring Nikki Hager into this conversation, researcher and writer. We first learned of him in this edition of the Covert Action Quarterly, which is based here in Washington, D.C., in this incredible piece called Exposing the Global Surveillance System. Nikki Hager, when you hear what's going on in this country, in the United States, around the FBI requesting of telephone companies to make it possible to tap tens of thousands of conversations at once, does this surprise you based on your research in New Zealand?
Oh, not at all. I don't know about the internal United States situation, but the systems which I've been documenting, which are about spying on international communications of the United States people and everyone else in the world, are already way beyond the points which you've been talking about, which means that already, and I can give you the detail of it soon, already it's not just possible, but it's the daily activity of the major intelligence organizations to monitor and process and use virtually all the long-distance communications of the world. I'm talking particularly about email and internet traffic and faxes and telexes, and to a slightly less certain extent, all the telephone calls of the world.
I want to step back for a minute and learn about this the way you taught it to me in your article. What is this global intelligence system, and how is New Zealand and the intelligence agency there tied into the National Security Agency, one of the largest agencies of the U.S. government, much larger than the CIA, that very few people know about?
I'll start with the second part first. You see, I was writing a book about New Zealand's equivalent of the National Security Agency, something called the GCSB here, which the more I learned about it, the more I realized was a, for historical reasons, was a kind of a junior clone or sort of model of the American NSA. The reason that New Zealand is part of that alliance was for very old reasons to do with the Second World War. But the practical effect of it is that today, in the area of electronic spying, which is what these organizations are about, spying on communications of different countries, New Zealand is the South Pacific representative of that larger American-led alliance. And what I found as I talked to, and more of these people, the intelligence agents were prepared to talk to me from within this agency and the related ones, is that all of their daily work was based around manuals and equipment and procedures and code words which had come from the United States. And so I was realizing I wasn't just learning about New Zealand systems spying within the South Pacific and Southeast Asia. I was being told about systems which were the ones in place for working around the world. And one of those which was the most fascinating, and which I was told about in such minute detail that moves it beyond the realm of sort of paranoid or speculative wondering, was a system called Echelon. This is a system coordinated by the National Security Agency from Washington, D.C., which has been, the point of which is to spy on all the major international telecommunications networks. That means satellite communications being between countries, it means cable communications between countries, also mean even, although these are diminishing, radio communications between countries. It talks about spying on microwave networks across continents and between countries. And the way it works is that each major lump or component of the world's telecommunication systems. In New Zealand, for example, we spy on satellites of the Pacific. Other parts of it spy on the microwave networks or the big land undersea networks. Each part of that has a secret station spying on it, tapping into it, and these are massive stations. These are stations not necessarily large in bulk, but in processing power. And unlike the old view of how you spied on people, which is that a particular person's phone number or email address would be fed into a system, these are thoroughly indiscriminate. For example, the station in New Zealand, which I virtually know my way around intimately, I've been told so much about it. The way it works is that it spies on the South Pacific satellite communications and processes everything. They process every fax and every email and everything going through it. And all of them are fed through giant computers, which are called dictionary computers. That's the code name for them.
Dictionary.
Dictionary, it's sort of a colourful term for it. And the way it works is that within those computers, there are electronically long lists of keywords. And every time the computer reads somebody's fax or internet message or whatever it is, with a keyword which has been put into the system, it automatically takes it out of that flow of tens of thousands of simultaneous messages that it's reading and sends it off to the intelligence agencies. What we learned in New Zealand, what I learned here in New Zealand from the staff of these places, is that the system has been highly organized to serve the organization which set it up, which is the American National Security Agency. And so that in New Zealand or in Britain or Australia or Canada, which are the primary allies, within their stations that they contribute to this network, they're not just their own nation's keywords for the targets that they're looking at. They're long lists of American keywords, and all those stations around the world function in effect as United States stations. And if our station here, if our secret intercept station, picks up a message, or as it picks up thousands of messages a day which are of interest to the United States because it contains words which they've asked us to put in the computers, the dictionary computers, they are sent automatically to Washington. So the effect of it, of the Echelon network, is that dotted around the world, at the end of lonely roads and windowless buildings where people aren't looking at them, and you can actually, to the best of my ability, documented where a lot of these are and where the each one is targeted on.
Nikki, when we
They're
come
covering
back,
the world system, yeah.
When we come back from a break, we want to find out where some of these places are here in the United States and also find out how it is exactly that the intelligence staff ended up telling you about what's been going on in New Zealand, which sheds a lot of light on what's going on in this country. We're talking to Nikki Hager, author of Exposing the Global Surveillance System, which is in the Covert Action Quarterly, this edition. And we're also joined by David Sobel, the legal counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center called EPIC here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we continue this amazing conversation about the global surveillance system and then look at legislation in this country. Again, we're joined by Nikki Hager, researcher and writer in Wellington, New Zealand, which is where we're speaking to him. And we're joined in the studio by David Sobel, who's with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Nikki, you were just about to say where some of these places are located in the United States and around the world, where some of these massive, is it satellites, buildings that are monitoring the world's communications?
Yeah, there's all kinds of facilities for the different elements of the world's telecommunications network which are being monitored. Some of them in the United States are at the NSA headquarters in Washington, not surprisingly. But the ones which I, other ones beyond there, are, for example, the ones which monitor satellite communications. And there's two needed in the United States for this. There is one at Yakima in Washington State, northwest United States, which is not very far from a highway there, which is cut through a great big army firing range. And if people stopped there and had a pair of binoculars, they could see a series of large dishes pointing out over the Pacific. And the function of those large satellite dishes is that they mimic, or they do the same function as a normal telephone company's earth station, which is using the satellites for communications. But there are extra ones within the system which are spying on all the satellite communications above the Pacific. And if you look at the directions which each satellite goes, they correspond to the satellites which are serving the world over there in that part of the world. Same on the other side of the United States. In West Virginia, there is a station at a small place called Sugar Grove, which at the end of a road up into the forest there has the same thing, a whole series of satellite dishes pointing out over the country. And let me just explain, there are a lot of other intelligence bases in the United States, and this is probably the main point that people need to adjust in their thinking about what the United NSA is doing and what this function is. There are other stations there and in other countries which for decades have had the function of spying on the Soviet Union in different ways and spying on Soviet satellites and being part of a military intelligence effort. The main difference about the systems which I'm talking about and this overall echelon network is that it's not spying predominantly on Cuba or North Korea or Iraq. It's actually spying on the telecommunications networks which are used by the members, the citizens of the countries concerned, and by friendly countries and their trading partners and their allies. It's actually a totally different function than the one in the past.
In fact, you mentioned that a lot of this is being used around GATT. Can you explain that?
GATT is one of the... Obviously, with so many people talking to me from within our system, I got told a lot about the intelligence which came pouring off the teleprinters in Wellington here into our intelligence agency, giving an indication of what they spy on. And some of it's economic, like spying on countries' GATT negotiations or the other kinds of international negotiations. A lot of it is political information. It's spying, in our case in New Zealand, we spy on all the prime ministers and their offices and all the government departments of our very friendly neighbours in the South Pacific. It is all the business of the world. And because in the 1990s, most countries do their business, and companies and individuals and organisations do their business electronically, not by letter, not face-to-face, when you can tap into all the faxes and all the email and so on, that's where the interesting intelligence is for these agencies.
Can you tell me why the staff of the Government Communications Security Bureau, known as the GSCB, your country's equivalent of the U.S. National Security Agency, why the staff decided to talk to you and how you ended up talking to more than 50 people who work there?
Yes, I mean, there's varying reasons for that. It didn't happen quickly. It happened over a period of time. And as I learned more, people were obviously more willing to talk to me. But I suppose there were two main reasons. One is that in the case of a very junior ally in the system like New Zealand, when the priorities and the systems and the whole push of the of what's going on, of the operations, is coming from quite a different country, the United States, with very different interests in many ways than New Zealand, the staff can start to feel uncomfortable about what they're doing, that we're spying on our friendly neighbours, that we're spying on our trading partners, that we're spying on, that we're engaged spying for people and against people in ways that might not be in the interests of our own country. And that was obviously alarming people. And there's another part to it which also offended people, and that is that the system was not set up by New Zealand. It was not set up by any of the allies. It was set up from the United States. And there's a large loss of sovereignty when you not only spy on behalf of other countries, but when you by the introduction of this echelon system, a final stage of giving away sovereignty happened where the facilities in our countries no longer spied indirectly for the allies or according to their priorities, but directly spied for them, which meant that we weren't even seeing, in the case of the now the way the system works, we don't even know what comes out of our own intelligence stations to Washington, because we've simply keyed in the instructions for them, and all the results, all the communications of our neighbours and trading partners and friends around the Pacific, all these different countries and probably our own people, go straight to Washington.
You know, I'm afraid we gave out some false information a few weeks ago. We had a guest on who said that international phone calls from this country, in fact, they are not necessarily monitored. But in fact, isn't it true that the NSA does, the National Security Agency based in Fort Meade, Maryland, does monitor every international phone call for these key words that you're talking about? It's not actually human beings listening to each call, but it's this overall intelligence set of satellites.
Yeah, I'm surprised someone said that to you. The whole point of these systems is that they don't target this person or that person. They're indiscriminate. That's just how they work. They put everything through and they search it for what they want. There's a couple of things. One thing I should say on this, though, my knowledge of exactly how much telephone traffic is being monitored automatically is not as clear as my information about the faxes and internet and so on, because in New Zealand's case, they don't, by our agency, process all the telephones simply because they don't have the resources to listen to it all. In the case of the United States, and David, your other guest, will know more about this than I do, there was actually a court case where the NSA established its right to monitor conversations by American citizens where the other end of the conversation was a foreigner. In other words, it was called the one terminal rule, I think, where if one party on a telephone conversation was not an American citizen, it was fair game for the NSA. Now that the NSA fought and won that court case is pretty clear evidence that the business is going on.
Well, I want to bring David Sobel back into this conversation of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Right now, I bet a lot of people are listening who are thinking, well, what are our ways to protect ourselves? Is there any way? What about encryption? And what is the government in this country doing about people getting a hold of encryption devices?
Okay, that really brings us to the hot controversy surrounding all of this, which is the center of the policy debate right now. What both Nikki and I have been talking about up until now is the question of access. In other words, I've been talking about the FBI's insistence on its ability to get access to telephone communications in the United States, and Nikki has been talking about the NSA's really remarkable ability to get access to international communications traffic. There is, however, a technological defense against this kind of interception, and it's encryption technology. This is the electronic means of scrambling communications in such a way that only the intended recipient has the ability to decrypt it and understand the communications. This has been a major part of what the National Security Agency's role has been both within the United States and around the world. I mean, since its inception in 1952, the NSA is the cryptographic expert of the world. Now, what's happened in the last few years is that that cryptographic know-how has ended as a monopoly of the National Security Agency and other governments around the world, and it's increasingly coming into the hands of regular people. And this has created a real crisis within the intelligence community, both within the United States and in other countries. Suddenly, cryptographic capabilities are commonplace. I mean, new powerful computer technology, I mean, the computers that sit on most of our desktops today, have the capability to very strongly encrypt and protect data. So the government is in the midst right now of a real powerful campaign, both at home and abroad, to restrict the ability of individuals to use powerful encryption. It most clearly manifests itself in United States export control policy, so that powerful encryption programs cannot currently be sent out of the United States. Now, that policy has the intended effect of also limiting the availability of this technology within the United States. The reason for that is that the major software vendors, such as Microsoft, are not going to go to the trouble of developing strong encryption capabilities in their products if they can't sell those products around the world. In other words, they will not create an export-only version of their software and a domestic-only version. So, in effect, this policy has held back the development and wide deployment of strong encryption capabilities. This is one of the hottest issues on the technology front right now, the question of whether or not the right to use encryption will remain within the United States, and what steps are going to be taken around the world to restrict
But even here, the Clinton administration is attempting to stop people from being able to encrypt things in certain ways.
Well, not domestically. I mean, that is what we anticipate. I mean, we see the long-term strategy on the part of agencies like the FBI and the NSA to be ultimately a domestic ban on the use of encryption. We have not gotten to that point yet, and that is something that my organization and other organizations that follow this issue have been warning about for a long time. And we basically say that the logic underlying the government's argument is such that a domestic ban is really going to be something that is going to be necessary from the government's perspective. After all, if the FBI is willing to redesign the telephone network, and the United States government is going to pay $500 million to redesign that system,
$500 million to be tapped,
$500 million to get at the data stream, they are not going to allow a situation to develop where all of that traffic is encrypted and they can't read it. So I think it's inevitable, unless there is consistent political pressure brought to bear on this issue, that we will eventually be involved in a fight over the domestic prohibition of encryption.
Now, some people might be thinking, Nikki Hager, well, you know, if there are terrorists out there, we want to be able to read their transmission or want the government to be able to read it. But one of the points you make is that since the end of the Cold War, so much of this is around economic spying, is around other kinds of spying on individuals who are not terrorists and individuals who are trying to go about their business in a somewhat private way.
That's very much my conclusion. These are systems predominantly which are most effective when they're used by a more powerful country or interest against less powerful people. But if I could just make a comment about the cryptology side too, I think that the intelligence agencies are actually going to lose this battle in the end, that they're not going to be able to stop the spread of this encryption technology. And I would urge your listeners and people who are interested in this to actually start using it. Not the very weak encryption that you normally have on a computer, which anyone could break, but to seek out the now highly publicly available strong encryptions that David was talking about and start to routinely use them. Regard it as no more strange to encrypt an electronic message than we do to seal the back of an envelope when we send the letter.
But how do you get this?
David can tell you. Yeah.
Yes, you can get it at through our website. We do have pointers to sites that distribute strong encryption programs such as PGP, Pretty Good Privacy. Now, there are restrictions for non-U.S. people to obtain that technology, but it is generally available around the world. A foreigner cannot access it from a United States site, but there are places around the world where it's available.
Give your address, your website address.
Our website is at www.epic.org, and at our homepage you will find a link that we call Privacy Tools, and that will bring people to the places where they can access encryption programs.
That's www.epic.org. Now, you just mentioned, Nikki, the idea of less powerful countries not having these tools. You talk about in your piece in the Covert Action Quarterly about how third world countries don't have access to this encryption. And this is a way for the superpowers, particularly the United States, to, you know, find out everything a third world country is doing around economic issues and other things.
Oh, yeah. And in the part of the world which I know best, which is the South Pacific, obviously, the governments here don't use encryption at all. They send their faxes between themselves and their embassies, between the countries, openly. But they even put them in English because they're going country to country, and that's a lingua franca. They're very easy pickings for the intelligence organizations, whereas a country like New Zealand or the United States already has high-level codes and no one could break its communications. And so I suppose this is another project which people might like to think about. And that is that if there are people involved in human rights groups or support groups for particular kinds of countries or individual countries, they should be promoting this technology, just as we try to, in various kinds of work, stop military intrusions on these countries. Just as important as the intelligence intrusions. And if interested organizations can make it their business to help human rights networks or networks of the pro-democracy people within particular countries, or even in many cases the governments themselves, if they're not, I'm not talking about repressive governments, but just vulnerable governments, help them to get this kind of encryption technology, then it helps to reduce the power of the big powers, which they have through their intelligence resources.
Well, Nikki and David, we have just touched the surface here, and we're absolutely going to be coming back to this discussion. But I want to let people know how they can get the article. Actually, it's a series of articles in the latest issue of the Covert Action Quarterly, The New Age of Surveillance. And I'm just looking inside the magazine now, and it does give a phone number here in Washington, D.C. And that phone number is 202-331-9763. That's 202-331-9763. And the email address is CAQ, that's for Covert Action Quarterly, CAQ@IGC.org. Quite amazing stuff. The website, mediafilter.org/CAQ. And we will continue to pursue this issue. I want to thank you very much, David Sobel of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Again, their website is epic.org. And I want to thank Nikki Hager for all the work you've done, both your article in the Covert Action Quarterly and your book, Secret Power, New Zealand's Role in the International Spy Network. In fact, Nikki, how can people get a hold of this book?
It's not widely available in the United States for commercial reasons, but Covert Action Quarterly and the Federation of American Scientists, or probably I should just mention Covert Action Quarterly, have bought a pile of them to make available when they put that article in. So it's available through them.
So, folks, you can call the Covert Action Quarterly. I want to thank you both very much for
thank
being
you.
With us
thank
on this edition of Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds, and we're going to go to an entirely different subject. We're going to go south to Colombia to look at the war there. You may think about the war on drugs. We'll be talking about the war on human rights. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last week we reported on the massive protests in Quito, Ecuador, that ended up toppling the president there, and this was just last week. And they were protests about economic austerity, the kind that are imposed by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Well, Colombia has just felt the reverberations of those protests and the toppling of the president, because yesterday the Colombian government bowed to demands for a stiff wage hike to end a strike that threatened to erupt in mass street protests, precisely because they saw what happened in Quito, Ecuador. That deal ended the week-old strike by public sector workers. It was hammered out during a marathon 30-hour negotiating session. Labor leaders hailed the deal as a victory for the estimated 800,000 workers who took part in the work stoppage. Government officials led by Colombian President Ernesto Samper said it was important because it guaranteed an end to labor unrest. Well, we're joined right now by someone who's just come up from Colombia, Michael Mogensen, and he is with Peace Brigades International. He spent the last year being an unarmed bodyguard of human rights activists in Colombia. And I wanted to begin, Michael, by asking you about these protests that have taken place and the strike that just ended.
I think it's extremely significant, particularly because of, I think it's definitely a repercussion from what workers were seeing going on in Ecuador, right next to Colombia. And also significant in that for years now, you haven't seen this kind of strike activity in the country and this kind of union power. Unions like unions around the world have been seriously weakened in within the past decade or so in Colombia. And so it's impressive that they were actually able to garner this kind of mass public outcry in Colombia and mass protest in Bogota. And particularly in the case of the announcement that they may delay the privatization of the state telephone company, Telecom. This has been an ongoing struggle in Colombia for the past several years. Telecom, the state telephone company, has been fighting the privatization. Their workers have been fighting the privatization, including there are several of the leading Telecom union leaders who spent quite a bit of time in jail in Colombia on sedition charges or on terrorism charges of having belonging to one of the different Colombian guerrilla groups. So it's really impressive that the government has been willing to back down somewhat, probably seeing what occurred right next door to them in Ecuador.
Did the workers belong to guerrilla groups?
No, I think it's clear that they did not belong to guerrilla groups.
Well, speaking about guerrillas, before we go into the kind of work that you've been doing over the last year, I wanted to first start by asking you what Peace Brigades International is.
Peace Brigades International is an international NGO or non-governmental organization which was founded in 1981. It was founded on Gandhian principles and also as a means of providing international support to nonviolent social movements around the world, particularly in the third world, although there is also some work here in this country and Canada on indigenous issues.
In Colombia, what were you doing?
In Colombia, we were accompanying or working with human rights organizations. So PBI, or Peace Brigades International, sends down a team of volunteers. They go into the country and they work usually for each person's there for around a year. And they what we call it nonviolent accompaniment. They accompany human rights organizations which have been threatened. Most of the people we accompany have been, had their lives threatened, or the organizations themselves have been seriously threatened.
On February 27th, President Clinton will release the list of countries that have not cooperated, as he deems it, not cooperated in the war against drugs. It's believed that Colombia will be on that list, as it was last year. Can you talk about what this war on drugs has been about in Colombia and what you think of government efforts to stem the flow of drugs?
I think there's certainly, first off, there's certainly no doubt that Colombia will be on that list. I think few people really suspect that Colombia could be recertified, but as long as Samper is the president of Colombia. This administration really dislikes Ernesto Samper. I think that's clear to everyone. And there is no doubt in the Clinton administration or in the U.S. State Department that Samper did receive several million dollars from the Cali drug cartel in his campaign fund. And so I think as long as Samper is president, then Colombia really stands no chance. However, Colombia right now, it has made some serious, I guess you could say, efforts to improve their record. I just read recently that they actually have extended, I think, to 60 years the amount of time that the drug lords can spend in prison. Before that, I think the Rodriguez Gacha, who was the head of the Cali drug cartel, was recently sentenced to about 5 or 10 years in jail, which people saw as being ridiculously low.
Well, in fact, just yesterday, lawmakers raised the stakes in Colombia's drug war by approving this legislation that triples the country's maximum penalty for narcotics trafficking.
And on top of that, also, the fact that it appears that the government, the Colombian government, is going to support lifting the constitutional ban on extradition, which was imposed 5 years ago. That's a huge deal in Colombia. Many lives were lost over the struggle over whether or not to extradite drug cartel leaders from the country.
And so now they're saying they will.
Now they're saying that they are willing to, again, to at least send the proposal to end the ban on extradition to Congress in Colombia.
What does all this have to do with human rights leaders in Colombia, the human rights leaders that you were following around, mm-hmm. bearing witness to?
Well, I think that our attention is constantly focused on the drug issue in Colombia, when what is really going on in Colombia is far more complex and far more horrible than I think what we can imagine. There is an unbelievable human rights situation in the country. In fact, Colombia probably has the worst human rights situation in the Western Hemisphere right now. An estimated 10 or 11 people die every day because of political reasons in the country, and that has nothing to do with the drug cartels.
Explain what it has to do with.
It has to do with people who are caught up in the war going on between the Colombian military and one of the three different guerrilla groups. It has to do with people who are branded as being subversives, union leaders in many cases, human rights workers in an endless number of cases, community leaders, teachers, peasant leaders, people like that.
I think in this country, most people would be surprised to learn that there's a war going on in Colombia.
Exactly. I think most people are surprised to find out there's a war going on that doesn't include the war on drugs in the country. And not just that, but just the abysmal human rights situation in the country. It's pretty shocking.
Just about a month ago, we had in representatives of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, who had both released reports around the revelations that money the U.S. government was sending to the Colombian military and aid that they were sending was going to kill, among others, human rights activists. Since you accompanied human rights activists, you're an unarmed bodyguard for the last year. Can you talk specifically about some people and the effects that the U.S. support of the Colombian military has on their lives?
Well, there's case after case, particularly in one region of Colombia, which is called the Middle Magdalena region. And we worked there on a permanent basis in this particular area of Colombia. cases of where the army battalions, which are carrying out the worst human rights abuses in that particular region, and therefore some of the worst human rights abuses in the whole country, are the army battalions which are receiving the most U.S. aid, or military aid, I should say. So that's one example. Another example might be the kind of advice that we give to Colombia's military. And in 1991, for instance, the United States State Department and the Department of Defense sent down military advisors to help Colombia restructure their military intelligence system. What came about from that was a restructuring, whereas the Colombian military began working really hand in hand with the different paramilitary groups in the country, a relationship which had already existed, but which was further strengthened, and even I think on a kind of on a higher level, meaning the for instance the Colombia's higher military command really had a hand in this. And the results of that relationship, which came about, for instance, in Barranca Bermeja, a city in the middle of Magdalena region, an estimated in 2 years' time, an estimated 50 to 60 community leaders, political activists, human rights workers were assassinated.
What is the attitude of human rights groups, of whole communities, to the U.S. government?
Well, definitely, I think people, there's an incredible amount of distrust in Colombia towards the United States, which I think is a distrust you find in most Latin American countries, but it's particularly marked in Colombia. It's an anti-Americanism, is one way of putting it, which doesn't necessarily have to do with the American people, but which does have everything to do with the United States' intentions and what exactly the United States is doing in those countries. Just a real suspicion of any kind of U.S. intervention or involvement in Latin America, and that certainly holds true in the human rights, in the human rights communities. People just can't really believe that the United States could be even, I think, capable in some ways of pushing Colombia towards respecting human rights. And so they tend to see U.S. involvement and human rights abuses as being a pretty direct link between the two. However, in that can change at times. For instance, the United States State Department recently put out a human rights report on Colombia, and it was a very hard-hitting report. And I think that those kinds of things do open up people's, particularly human rights workers and the human rights community in the country of Colombia. It opens their eyes a little bit to the what can be done in a positive way to improve the human rights situation in the country.
We're talking to Michael Mogensen, and he just returned from Colombia, where he was a Peace Brigades International volunteer, an unarmed bodyguard for human rights leaders in Colombia. What about the guerrillas? Who are they? Isn't it also true in the report, the State Department report, they talked about, what, narco-guerrillas or narco-terrorists?
Mm-hmm. I don't know about the State Department human rights report, but it's been the case in the past where the term narco-guerrilla has been used. And in fact, a previous U.S. ambassador to Colombia is the man who actually invented that term, the narco-guerrilla. The current U.S. ambassador, Miles Frechette, has really been careful not to mention the narco-guerrilla and kind of tried to steer away from that kind of terminology, and has in fact on one occasion even said that he wasn't willing to support the idea of a narco-guerrilla or of a guerrilla drug cartel until he saw some kind of concrete proof. But the U.S. State Department recently, I'm actually not sure of the man's name, but a man who works with Burns in the United States State Department did recently say that there was what he felt like overwhelming evidence that the guerrilla organizations were basically another drug cartel in the country. And I find that to be ludicrous. It's certainly not the case that I came across in the country. Definitely the guerrilla organizations have been involved in the drug trade in the country. There's no doubt about that. They control large areas where coca is being grown. They certainly wage attacks on the drug cartels, where the drug cartels have to pay the guerrilla organizations in order to be able to grow the crop in their regions of influence, those kinds of things. But that the different guerrilla organizations in the country are actually a drug cartel on the level of the former current Medellin drug cartel and the Cali drug cartel is really not the case.
What do these guerrilla groups want? Why are they fighting the government?
Well, they have an ideology, and the ideology came out of the 1960s. These groups have been around since the 1960s. And in fact, they're the longest running guerrilla insurgency in Latin America right now. And so basically they want to, I think on paper, they still believe in an overthrow of the state and actually capturing Bogota and taking power in the country. But I think in reality, what they want is to put pressure on the government or to make some kind of serious concessions, opening up the political process in the country, allowing an alternative, a political alternative in the country, nationalization of industries, things like that.
What kind of support do guerrillas have in the country?
The support is limited. It's certainly not the kind of support that you saw in Central America in countries like El Salvador or in Guatemala. However, the support is there, especially as a kind of a counterweight to the government. I think a lot of people will play each side off the other in a way, or their resentment is so strong towards the government in some cases that they sympathize with the guerrilla organizations. But it's not a support where people are really, in most cases, willing to believe that the guerrilla organizations could take power or even want them to take power in the country. The support that you do find is generally in the countryside and also among some middle-class intellectuals on university campuses and things like that.
Michael, you were involved in this last year in accompanying threatened human rights leaders, particularly the Colombian Association of Relatives of the Detained and Disappeared. What kind of work do they do?
The Colombian Association of Relatives of the Detained Disappeared is a group which came about as people began to disappear in Colombia, a phenomenon which wasn't really common in the country, especially in the 1970s when it was going on in places like Argentina and Chile and Brazil. But then in the 1980s, especially around about the middle of the 1980s, disappearance became a common occurrence in the country. Beforehand, generally, there were a lot of political prisoners in the country. The jails were full of political prisoners. There was a lot of torture being carried out in the country. But disappearance, per se, wasn't yet a common phenomenon in the country. And what you see now is that disappearance is extremely common, and you don't find nearly as many political prisoners in the jails and as many cases of people being taken prisoner and then being tortured. And so it's a much more common occurrence that someone is detained. There's no record of that detention. They're tortured, and then their body may appear or it may not. It may never appear. And so these are relatives who began to come together and to work together to try and find some kind of answer as to where their relatives were, and also to fight the system, the impunity that you find in country, trying to bring the people responsible to justice.
An all too common occurrence in places like El Salvador and in Guatemala even today. Are the discovery of graves, mass graves of people who were killed by paramilitary groups. Does that happen in Colombia?
Yeah, it does happen. We've attended, as PBI, Peace Brigades International, we accompanied this Association of Relatives of the Detained Disappeared to a mass grave in the region of the province of Cordoba. I think there was an estimated, I'm not sure on this figure, an estimated 40 bodies or so. And these were people who had been taken and killed and then buried in this mass grave from one particular village.
What does the government say about this?
The government, to a certain extent...
And do you know who's responsible?
In this case, it was clear that the responsibility lied with paramilitaries. One of the different paramilitary groups in that particular region, and there was clear indications that they were working with the military at least to some extent. And that's often what we've come across, is that the particularly now, where the worst massacres taking place are often carried out by paramilitaries, which kind of enables the military to step aside and say, well, we didn't have anything to do with this. This was carried out by one of these illegal paramilitary organizations.
And what is the relationship of the paramilitaries to the military in Colombia?
It's a complex relationship. It's certainly not the case, I think, where in every case they're working hand in hand. But there is lots of evidence that in many cases they have worked hand in hand, where the military has provided them with weapons, has provided them with military intelligence, has told them what exactly they want the paramilitaries to do.
Michael Mogensen, we have to go. I want to thank you for joining us, Michael Mogensen with Peace Brigades International. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Our executive producer, Julie Drizin. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order it by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And if you'd like to hear Michael Mogensen,